This is the Coast 89.7 Weekly News Magazine, Dialogue, highlighting local news stories and events in our Cape Breton communities.
Hello and welcome back to Dialogue on the Coast 89.7. I'm Bill McCush. This week, times are tough for a lot of people out there, especially for the young ones who are literally using water to fill their cereal bowls, but a local food bank is trying to put an end to that. We have a documentary focused on the scientists and researchers in and outside of Ukraine who have been disrupted by the Russian invasion. A Cape Breton musician says him and the boys are looking forward to plugging in at the Savoy for the first time since the late 70s, and the Port of Sydney CEO tells us Fiona wreaked havoc on their schedule, but there's already about 100 ships ready to come here next year. That's up first with Bill Bradley and Marlene Usher.
Earlier in the year, we chatted with the CEO, Marlene Usher, to find out what kind of year we're expecting. And here we are, Marlene, capping off the year. First of all, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you very much, Bill.
We reached out to you early in the cruise ship season and see how things were going. And, of course, then came along Fiona. And despite that, it was still a pretty good year, right?
Yes, you're right. It was. Fiona really hurt a lot of people, obviously, but our sector was impacted to the extent that we lost 15 calls. So that was a lot. It was our busiest week of the entire season that we lost, but we fared okay overall.
Because you're supposed to have almost three ships per day coming in that week, right?
That's right. There was at least three ship days.
But you did have a rebound of sorts because you had one ship come in that wasn't scheduled there a while back, right?
That's correct. We actually had three.
Oh, really?
Overall, yeah, we had three. Before that, when the hurricane was impacting elsewhere, we got two unscheduled calls. So we did get net like three. We're only down 12 if you look at it that way.
Well, that's a good thing. So, and you're out and about, and I know you got a busy schedule there each and every day, especially this week with the cruise ships in every day, and then one in November as well, right?
That's right. And the last day is November 4th.
What seems to be the big thing, the highlight that they'd like to spread on and you'd like to spread on to other people to come back to Cape Breton Island?
Well, first of all, people love our cruise pavilion. It's probably one of the nicest pavilions in the whole eastern region. Because when this was designed back in early 2000, it was designed specifically for that, to attract cruise passengers. And that's why the big fiddle was constructed. And, you know, we tried to present our culture and music along with that. But also we have a craft market, which is very high end. We have 70 or more of fine crafters from Cape Breton, and that's a big, big popular event, and they do well there. But in addition to that, you can imagine the tours that Cape Breton has with, you know, the Cabot Trail, the Fortress of Louisbourg, the Miners Museum, Museum Downtown, the Iona. It's endless kind of what we have to offer. And Cape Breton is somewhat iconic in the tourism world in the sense of our accolades that we've received as one of the best islands for tourism. So people, when they come off the ship, they are keen to be here and they are keen to tour the island. The other thing I'd like to mention is downtown, which has been historically a bit of a struggle with the investment that we're making in our downtown Sydney. That will also, you know, be really helpful in terms of offering our guests a high-class experience.
Do you get people coming back for a second time or telling people that they know to come to Cape Breton Island because of their experience here?
We do. We have a lot of people that, in fact, they say, well, I'm coming back and I'm going to bring my family. So they're coming back, not necessarily by cruise, but by another means. We get feedback from the cruise lines themselves because they do surveys. They survey their passengers and they ask them about their experiences in each port. So we get debriefed by the lines about what, you know, what was lacking or what was perceived as, you know, maybe areas that we could improve. But they also tell us when we've done a good job and what our passengers like. So we get it both on both from the passengers and the lines. And it's, you know, that's what we need. We need honest feedback, and we've responded to that over the years.
Well, all that being said, what does it look like for next year? Is any, and I know it's too early to kind of put a number out there, but what kind of feedback are you getting as far as numbers and people coming next year with cruise ships?
It's actually not too early because we don't put our numbers out because they change all the time, but we have well over 100 ships booked for next year on our books now, and we have ships booked into 2026. They book well in advance, and the bookings for next year are strong, and they should, if things go accordingly, we should have our best year ever next year.
So amongst those ships, I know we had a couple of new ones in. Is there going to be new ones on top of that, or is it going to be the same cruise ship lines coming into Sydney?
It'll be the similar lines, but there will be new ships because if you go and research, there's cruise ships on the order books all of the time. And so they come on stream and they make their way to Sydney eventually. And when they do, we have a little bit of a ceremony to welcome their first port of call in Sydney. So there's definitely will be new ships.
I know you're looking after the port of Sydney, but I also see on the list this year there was a couple of cruise ships that actually had stopped into Lewisburg, which is great for that community.
It is great for Lewisburg, and we work closely with Lewisburg. We handle the calls in Lewisburg for the lines, and the community there has embraced it. They've made sure that there's things for the passengers to do. They've tried to put out the welcome mat, and they've done a good job. They've been impacted a bit by weather too, but the calls that they have been successful.
Well, Marlene, appreciate this, and all indications are from what you've said it's going to be a banner year next year, and hopefully the weather is going to stay good.
Hopefully. Yeah, I hope so, Bill.
Community leader Mickey McNeil is on the line with Ron Neville asking for your help with just one of the local campaigns designed to help people who are facing tough economic times.
So the milk drive, this has become kind of a yearly tradition here in the local area to raise funds and collect milk, whether it be powdered or canned milk for the food bank. Can you tell us a little bit about the history of the milk drive?
Yes, sir. It started approximately 8-9 years ago when we found out that there were actually children putting water on cereal. And we decided to do something, try to raise money or milk somehow to help them out. And it's been going fantastically every year, like with the we usually get a large donation from PEI, ADL Milk Company over there usually sends over quite a bit. But the local people really, really help out. Like we get e-transfers from Vancouver, Toronto, New Brunswick. And the beauty of it is we are open from approximately 8 a.m. to 12 midnight, 7 days a week. So if you're driving by the Dominion Arena, you might have picked up your groceries. That's 8 or 9 o'clock. You have some milk. You want to drop it off. The lobby is open. You just walk in, drop it in there on the table. And this is usually a 2-week drive we have. We usually wrap it up, I believe it's November 6th. And it is one of the biggest needs that the food bank has. I recall asking the lady, I mean, we all think they need cereal or cans of soup or something, and I asked her what her greatest need was, and that's when they told me it is can or powdered milk.
All right. So now the everybody's gone through a hard time with Fiona over the last number of weeks. How has that affected things as far as the food drive? Do you think it'll be become a bigger issue this year, like getting more to get more milk and funds raised?
Well, it's like they, you know, every year the need does get greater, and I know with a lot of people had to throw a lot of food out. I mean, 7, 8, 9, 10 days without power, they had no choice. So
even 11 days, I was without for 11.
Well, like I said, see, and all these people, I mean, the food banks are going to be overwhelmed, and which makes milk even that much more important. The ladies down at the Glace Bay Food Bank are awesome people. You can e-transfer money to the Glace Bay Food Bank, or you can give me a call. If you have a case of milk at home and you have no way of getting it up to the arena, feel free to call me and I'll go pick it up. And my home phone number is 902-849-4320. That's 902-849-4320. I will gladly go and pick it up. Like I said, the table is set up right there in the lobby, and it usually starts off pretty slow. But then as we get close to the final few days, more and more people start dropping off milk.
All right, very good. And do you have a particular money goal, a number that you're aiming for this year as far as the amount of donations or the money, the actual amount of milk that you're looking for?
Well, like always, you like to increase it. Last year was a bumper crop year for us with donations. And we were able to raise enough money to buy 3 new freezers for the Glace Bay Food Bank. And we had to be anywhere between 15 and 17,000. And that is including the milk also from PEI. So it's people, they just want to give. They want to help out. I mean, and it's like I said, if you can only afford 2 cans of milk, that's 2 cans of milk they didn't have. So every can of milk counts, and the powdered milk is not cheap, by no means. And I always tell people, if you're going to get canned milk, don't spend $2 or whatever on a big brand name can of milk. Buy the no-name brand milk. Milk is milk. So you're going to end up getting 2 or 3 extra cans of milk that you had you gone the other way, you wouldn't have been able to do it.
And what are the hours? You said that people can drop off the milk to the Dominion Rink.
Well, like I said, we're open 7 days a week. We open up at approximately 8:30 in the morning, and we're there till approximately 12 midnight 7 days a week. So the lobby doors are open, so you just walk in. Table is set up there with the sign, and you can put your milk right there on the table. And like I said, if you want to go to the Glace Bay Food Bank, you can. And like I said, they accept monetary donations too, and so every little bit helps. And we have to thank people like the Coastal Radio for getting the word out there to all the people in the area. So we really hope that this is even going to be a better year than last year. So anyway, thank you very, very much for all you guys do for us.
That's Mickey McNeil. He is the head of the Mickey's Original Six Society and the organizer for the Milk Drive, and that is starting today, running right through until the 6th of November. And as Mickey was mentioning, you can drop off your donations anytime from 9 a.m. until midnight daily, right up until November the 6th.
We have a special presentation on the coast this week. It's about the trauma of the war in Ukraine and intergenerational PTSD. We'll hear about the state-of-the-art telepresence, a technology that induces a sensation of being elsewhere, and how it can be a powerful tool to interrupt the war playing out in people's minds.
As war continues in Ukraine, stories are doing battle.
Fear and also anxiety and also rage, and this is a part of our realities.
Stories that fight for hearts and minds. It's been a war of conflicting narratives.
My name is Katerina Yakovlenko. I'm visual culture researcher and journalist. I mean, I don't know how to solve it in a different way. I think it's not a question for Ukraine to change Russian impression. It's not our goal.
People are living with stories of war, no matter what side they're on. Stories that will live long after the conflict ends.
There's lots of opportunities for us to build peace. And hopefully Canada will send over some of our assets in peace building as readily as we send over assets for war making.
And when finally there's peace in Ukraine and Russia, there will also be PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, a mental struggle that for some never ends.
There are scholars out there, indigenous scholars as well, who are looking at the effects of trauma on brain development, all those sorts of things. And you did make it clear that PTSD or trauma not transformed is transferred.
That's Lewis Cardinal, an Indigenous Cree elder and cultural facilitator in Canada. More from him in a moment. And you'll also be hearing more about PTSD and war and how we might find peace in a digital world. The invasion of Ukraine is the first digital conflict of consequence in the 21st century. It's an asymmetric blend of mobile media and storytelling social mediums. This is new. What's not new is Ukrainians and Russians and their children's children may be troubled by the analog of unresolved feelings recycled over and over and over. Hold that thought.
Yeah, I mean, I think that psychologists are working also right now on the frontline zone just to give some very fast help for people and for children especially. But I think that the most important work would be done after war will over, because we still have this traumatical experience. So trauma is not maybe formed right now. And sometimes you can you may think that this is like the most horrible thing that you witnessed, but actually it's not, so we don't know what would be in the future.
But I have some personal experience about what that might look like. After World War II, my mother was among the millions of displaced persons in Europe. And for the rest of her life, she struggled with PTSD. Unpredictable emotions would get the better of her from time to time. And as a kid growing up in a mining town in northern Ontario, I couldn't understand what she was going through. And every time there was an underground blast, which signaled the end of a shift at the mine nearby, I felt her tension. Research scientists I've interviewed tell me PTSD can echo upstream and manifest as intergenerational trauma. An ancestor's suffering can be inherited. Severe distress genetically alters DNA. That's the coding for life. Raising the possibility of passing along fears and anxiety, what scientists call an epigenetic memory, to future offspring. For Canada's Indigenous people of the First Nations, intergenerational trauma is a fact for many lives.
That's why it's going to take more than money to deal with the issues. And again, it's a very highly emotional topic to get into. Oh, certainly. And there's a lot of trauma that we're still trying to identify as to how deeply it has affected us. And we know, as you stated, the epigenetics of ourselves also changes and shifts. But what we also know is that when you enter into a ritual, if you will, or a ceremony, that helps to transition into that place of pain and also transition out. So it becomes a very helpful. That's why I say that the real changes are going to come when the people sit and talk and they start to develop their own things without being directed by the government. The government has a nasty habit of just throwing money at things, but never really throwing processes to people. So that's something that I think that we can learn. And it is going to take generations to address.
Louis Cardinal and I have been friends for years. And in 2016, it was in Montreal where we both met René Barcelot. He's a digital media pioneer in Quebec and one of the principal artists at the Society of Arts and Technology, SAT, a world leader in immersive software and digital technologies like virtual reality. What René describes next is part of an art solution I have in mind to interrupt PTSD's long-lasting grip.
So we're back in about 10 years ago, and I'm doing a conference presenting in front of First Nations people who were responsible of Internet Community Access Center. And I was listening, and there was the guy from the government who came in first, and he asked, oh, you can fill in these forms on the net, and whatever. And suddenly I come in, I present what we do at SAT, which is arts and technology. We dance together, we play music together, we can control equipment at distance together, and they're all excited. And at the end of my conference, when I came back through the room, the elderly asked me to come to sit down with them. I was kind of shocked. And they said, you know, this could really help us to save our culture. Because what the government just presented us is we have to enter information through keyboards to fill in the forms. So they realized that suddenly there was a way that they can communicate directly the way they always did, like looking at the person in the eyes and everything. So a few months afterwards, I met another person in Vancouver, Chris Corrigan, which is somebody who does a lot of active community workshops, connection things. And he's also from First Nations background. And he told me that what they were trying to tell me is that when he was a child, he met his uncle, who wanted to teach him a certain part of the oral history. And as a young person who went to school, he got out his notebook to take notes and not forget anything. But his uncle said, no, you'll forget everything if you write it down. Because if you don't write it down, you'll feel it in your heart. And that's empathy. And then you'll never forget it.
Empathy. Remembering with your heart. Your body has memory, good and bad. What I'm about to tell you is counterintuitive if you're trying to forget trauma. But for psychotherapists and for people who have trouble expressing the terror of inexplicable emotions that's getting the better of them, Jim Ruxton's recent work with Canada's Vibra Fusion Lab, to my way of thinking, is another piece of an art solution.
What I'm working with is the idea that you can take sound and turn that into vibration. So, for example, for this piece that I'm working on right now with the Vibra Fusion Lab, this show called Scored in Silence, it's a piece about the experience of deaf people in Hiroshima and Nagasaki when the atomic bomb hit. Deaf people were unaware what was going on. They didn't hear the news. They didn't hear the bomb go off. It's quite an experience. It's made for both a deaf audience and a hearing audience. So through this piece, people wear a vibratactile device and they're able to experience the sound of the piece through vibration.
There's a couple of telling moments in the demonstration video that is online. Let's talk a bit about that, because that was very interesting to me, that the suddenly things that were transparent became apparent.
Yeah, I suppose that's very true, that because there are times in the piece, for example, when it is silent, all you do is feel things. So in that sense, you're kind of being brought into the deaf experience.
Let's stay with that for a moment more. But when you said a few moments ago, in the silences, I have also been in the room with people who can't tell their stories because it's just too terrible. But I think what you've accomplished here is an ability to tell the story without telling it.
one thing that we found is the idea of vibrotactility is very rich in terms of therapeutics for people with autism, for example, things like that. People just grasp onto it and it's just so soothing. And when you kind of see that and experience that, it's true, you feel a lot of empathy. There is definitely this translation of empathy going on when you see people who gravitate so much towards that. So I think in terms of using the vibrotactile systems for therapeutic uses, I think we just scratched the surface on that. There's so many ways we can go with it.
Jim Ruxton. While I was preparing this podcast, a couple of newspaper articles, one in the UK's The Guardian, the other in The Washington Post, reported an estimate of how many Ukrainians are experiencing psychological distress during this war, and how many are expected to suffer post-traumatic stress disorder. They number in the millions, and many will require psychotherapy. It's a medical emergency that sanctuary nations are ill-equipped to handle. For refugees who sought shelter in the UK, for instance, The Guardian reports the current waiting list to see a PTSD specialist is 2 years. 2 years just to see someone. Think of that as an analog approach. But keep in mind, this is a digital war playing out in near real time on social media. And people in Ukraine, notably young people, are comfortable with their mobile devices and computers. Could they also get comforted by them? Again, here's Renny Barcelo.
One project I did helping to create was that with the Children's Hospital, we had opened up a creative lab space. And I talked with the doctors, and one of them was a psychologist for children. And they were working with children who could not establish contact, human contact, with an adult. So they were talking behind mirrors, and they were saying, how could we improve that? And the idea we got was the children could draw a persona or whatever they would be willing to talk to. And then we could peg that and animate it like a puppet and show it on the wall. But the animation and the talking of the lips would be done by taking the voice of the psychologist. So it was not a computer who was talking to the children, but it was a real human. But he was using a persona that the children was ready to take. So those are things that we can do, visuals and telepresence and only a smart part of it.
Digital, interactive, therapeutic. There's something in this for people who are going to have to learn how to get along, share the same space, when war ends. And what can be learned historically about how the First Peoples in Canada resolved their conflicts, such as they were between the Blackfoot and Cree in a vast territory that looks a lot like the flat, fertile plains of Ukraine? What is it about making music together? The folk singer Pete Seeger was a master of encouraging a crowd to sing together. There's an art to it. You must raise your voice, but sing too loudly, you're no longer in a choir. The trick is to find the sweet spot, gently adjusting your interaction and intention. The digital equivalent is a responsive telepresence. I'll explain how that works in greater detail upstream.
Years ago, I wrote a note to Pete Seeger saying, wars are easier to stop than to end. Wars are easier to start than to stop. And he really liked that, so he used that in one of his articles that he writes. And it led me to think when this war started that we ought to begin planting the seeds of peace.
Peter Poole, he lives in Banff, a Rocky Mountain community that's home to Canada's first national park. It's a special gathering place and has been for thousands of years.
It's interesting. The context of Banff gives me comfort to express issues about peace. And why? We have from two different traditions, a very old Blackfoot tradition and also from Stoney tradition. Those two parties weren't always in agreement. They were punching one another's noses regularly. But they also had, we hear stories of wars between two groups. We often don't hear about the efforts for peace between those two groups. However, in this valley, Elder Blackfoot, this has long been a place where people came to lay down their weapons and meet in peace.
And certainly for a very long time, we've had a relationship with the Blackfoot. Now, what's more popularly known now is that the Blackfoot and the Cree were traditional enemies. But when you do your research and you look back in history and you go back through some oral histories, actually, the Blackfoot and the Cree were pretty close together. They had a positive relationship for quite some time, so much so that there's Cree words within the Blackfoot language. And that shows, as linguists say, that there was a close connection between them. But as any other peoples around the world, when you start to compete for trading routes, trading places, conflict is born. And that's just something that human beings do.
Lewis Cardinal. If this kind of sounds like the situation for Ukraine and Russia, living side by side in a similar yet conflicted landscape, you'd be right to think that.
However, because we know that as indigenous people, we know that human beings are flawed. We take too much. We get destructive. We become righteous. We cause problems. But what we also know to be true is that really what you're doing is you're stepping out of balance of relationships. And so what we recognize is that there are ceremonies that help pull us back into balance and harmony. Because the goal through indigenous worldviews collectively is that it's to pursue that balance and maintain that balance and harmony with how you live and who you live with and your relationship to the environment, of course. And so ceremonies then become an important part of that. So, and we see that through the history with Blackfeet and Cree, is that they would get out of balance with each other.
And so to restore balance, special gathering places were set aside to meet up and work toward a common understanding. Places like Banff in the mountains and other unspeakably beautiful spots in the territory nearby. Unclaimed neutral locations like the Cypress Hills.
Well, where indigenous people would usually gather, even here in Edmonton, going way back, it was also known as a sacred gathering place. And sacred because when you come together in relationship, trading relationship or what have you, the location at which where you're meeting becomes that much more special. So a part of that then is engaging in a ceremony where we would agree to meet with each other on a regular basis. And with Cypress Hills, it was a place where it was identified as common ground or sacred ground. And the understanding was that you don't make war there. You don't dirty up the place with violence. And just to get, you know, just to let you know, the Peace Hills was another place where the Blackfoot and the Cree had buried the hatchet, so to speak. And when we came together and we recognized that what we were doing was destructive to each other and not really moving anything forward, we had to come to the conclusion that it's better for us to live in peace than it is in conflict.
But not everyone can get to Banff or the Cypress Hills, or Peace Hills for that matter. However, it is possible to export the scenery and perhaps the sense of well-being in a digital simulation of these special places. It's an idea Lewis Cardinal and I first proposed in 2017 to commemorate Canada's 150th anniversary as a country. We thought if we could get people to dance with virtual beings, the rock art iconography, for instance, found at some special places, well, that would be a good thing for truth and reconciliation between the First Nations and the immigrants who came to settle and colonize Canada. You can see what I'm talking about linked to the podcast series website, and I'll tell you what that link is at the end of this podcast.
What I've learned from the artists at SAT,
Renny Barcelo,
was that suddenly when you take a picture of a video of a person and you can present it at the same scale normally as you would see when you have a conversation with somebody, you can trick the brain for that person being there. That's the most important thing that I found. If it's too big, then you can play with drama. If you want to make it big and Big Brother or very, very small, but the connection has to be made human scale. And when you're in human scale after a certain area of period, the brain really believes that we're together, especially if you can have a full body projection. Right now, I can see you because I have a large screen, almost as human scale, but not enough. But if I could see you full scale on a wall and see you at, then it's totally different. So for enabling connections of therapy or things like that, I think that is the is a very comforting space in which suddenly you can open up yourself and maybe talk to the other people or something like that.
And if you're thinking, can't we already do this on Zoom or Skype? There's a problem with that thinking, and it's psychological.
That's one thing in teleprésence that I feel is not working. And we realized it when we did seminars in which you have 15, 20 people on the screen suddenly, but you always have yourself. And then your mind is always, look, am I looking right? Am I this? Are you listening or are you looking at yourself? Suddenly, when you don't look at yourself and you close yourself and you look at the other person, then you can establish a connection, like in real life. And it's really interesting to disconnect yourself in order to be with the other.
He's describing a kind of friendly schizophrenia. Have I got that right?
It has to be a mix of real presence and teleprésence. It has to be a mix of the two. You cannot live only in the metaverse. If you do that, you're going to lose yourself. You have to be a connection. My understanding today is that, yes, my head can travel whatever I want to go in real time, in metaverse or whatever, but my body needs to have his feet somewhere. And these feet have to be within a community, and I have to talk to people. I'm not connected all the time. So the best thing for me is the connection of the two, a local presence, a local area in which you can get support, touch real people, and then a space which then can be open to dream, to connect, to reinvent the world, to see your fears and tell them that you're not afraid anymore or whatever. But that's a special space in which when you come back, you need to have somebody to be close to.
And if this sounds like an opportunity in digital space to find common ground for Ukrainians and Russians to create the conditions for an epiphany, perhaps it all begins with finding ways to tell each other's story and tell them well in a digital gathering, to respond and listen with the fullness of the body and a curiosity for each other's intent. This is what I mean by a responsive telepresence. I'll leave the last word with Lewis Cardinal.
When you exchange story with another people, it's amazing how you start to find commonalities or sometimes the very same experiences. That naturally brings people together. I'm in the belief that as human beings, we have a lot more common than we do in difference with each other. So a part of the strategy is the storytelling part of it, because that really resonates with an individual. Because if you can start to see yourself in another person's story, you're taking that first step or offering that first thread that you can start to pull on and eventually build a bridge. And I think that because we have social media and some tools and abilities, we may not have it perfect right out of the gate to have that interaction online or digitally. That then will lead into deeper discussions, because in order to get deeper into the conversations, you need to have trust. And so relationship building, utilizing these tools will help build that trust. So it's not going to, you're not going to deal with these great differences, you know, in a matter of a couple sessions. It's going to take a while, and there needs to be a commitment to do just that.
Matt Minglewood is no stranger on the Coast playlist, and he's always generous with his time catching up with our on-air hosts. Minglewood chats with Bill Bradley about his first show coming at the Savoy in more than 40 years. He hopes cooler heads prevail this time, because last time he was here, it was greasy work, but God, it was fun.
the incomparable, the amazing, incredible. I could go on and on and on and on and on and on. There's a musician that stands out here in Cape Breton Island. I know he's not going to agree with me because he's very humble. I'd like to welcome Matt Minglewood to the program. Welcome.
Hey, good morning.
How are you?
I'm doing great.
You've been very busy. I see last weekend you were in Lunenburg playing Oktoberfest and all kinds of gigs planned before Christmas, including one that you have coming up at the Savoy Theater. Now, this is a special one for you because I noticed on the Savoy Theater Facebook page and webpage that you said it's been a while since you performed in your own hometown, and it's just something special about coming back and performing at the Savoy Theater.
Oh, yeah. It's a beautiful venue. It's one of the best around, you know. So, and I haven't really played there with my band probably since 1979. It was a little rowdy that night.
Okay.
And so I didn't really play there since, but times have changed. Things are different now. My audience is not quite as rowdy as they used to be. They're older now.
But I'm sure they still have those feelings.
Yeah, probably. They just can't do it anymore.
Exactly. Speaking about doing it, you've been doing this since you're a kid. I know you're a very humble guy, but you're approaching 76 years of age. What motivates you each and every time you go on stage to do this?
I've always, my biggest passion with music was always playing live. That's what I was known for. That's what the band was known for. And so I still get a big charge out of actually doing that. It's what I do. It's what I love to do. And, it's nothing better than getting on stage with a bunch of your friends and great players and just having a ball. So besides all of that, I mean, there's a lot of work. The work is the driving and the booking and the hotels and all that's the work. But the play, that's why they call it, I'm going to play music. It's not going to work. So. I haven't worked a day in my life.
That's a good way to feel about it. But you've been performing for years, and like that old Hank Snow song, I think I've been everywhere. You've been everywhere.
Yeah, not quite everywhere, but I've been into an awful lot of places.
All across this beautiful country many, many times. And you're playing a show coming up at the Savoy Theater on Saturday, yes. November 5th. It's Through the Years. And let's talk about that for a bit. Through the years, you must have heard some incredible stories about the people in our community. Any of that transcended into the way you write music or even made it to paper because of a story that you heard on the street or maybe one of the gigs that you played?
Oh, absolutely. A lot of my songs are based, you know, about growing up in Cape Breton and then traveling other places, right? But, you know, the Cape Breton roots are evident through, especially the early stuff. So, yes, it has a great amount to do with where I grew up in terms of the songs. And we plan on revisiting some really old stuff. I'm going to go back even as far as the Rockin' Saints to
pull
one out of the hat. And I'm going to try to build it through the years and right up into the modern, the latest stuff, you know. So we're going to we'll do some acoustic things and we'll do some, we'll end up getting it rocking. So, because that's what we do. We like to get out there and play and go for it every time.
So with the music, you know, people will be able to hear it through the years, but I'm sure there'll be stories in between the music, how you got to that point and how that song came about.
Oh, absolutely. You know, it's going to be a lot of interaction with stories and how things came about and what was happening in my life at that time, you know, so I'm really looking forward to it.
Well, there's on your Facebook page, Matt Minglewood, there's a question there. What year and where did you first see Moon Minglewood or the Minglewood Band perform? And one of the answers were from Angela, and she says, I first saw you at the Sears as a kid in the early 80s selling an album, and then as a teenager in the late 80s at the Misty Moon, and years later at the Pig and Whistle in Mabu, 1990, where I danced with my husband for the first time to Can't You See, and still, for the last 32 years, still continue to dance. And you are a treasure to Canadian music all over the world. Seeing you still rock and roll at Judic on the floor was amazing, and everybody loves you. I mean, you get comments like that. It makes it all worthwhile to perform.
Oh, it absolutely does. You know, there's nothing better than making bringing some people joy, you know, especially nowadays in this crazy world with a lot of hatred being spewed around. And so it's just great to get out and play and have people laughing and dancing and fun. That's what I love to see.
Well, I have another one on here on your Facebook page. Camilla says, it was probably 1972 in Shadow Camp, either at the Acadian Lounge or the Acadian Center. You nicknamed me, I love this, the Margarine Maiden, because I was pretty much at every show after hitchhiking within the distance for that 3 years. Do you know who that person is?
Yes, I do. And actually, it was way back in when Sam, the Moon Minglewood days, I think that she... used to start coming to the shows and stuff, and she's a great person, and so I think it might have been Sam that called her the Marguerite Maiden.
But there's probably a pretty good chance that she'll be at the show coming up at the Savoy.
I hope so.
Well, looking forward to the show coming up on November the 5th at the Savoy Theater. Still some tickets available. And we are so happy again. Your last show, they had a member to be part of it, and we're so happy to be part of it again. Still rocking after all these years.
Oh, thank you. See you there.
Gonna know. Can't you see? Can't
That's all for Dialogue this week. Thanks for listening. I'm Bill McCush.
Catch Dialogue 3 times weekly, Sunday at noon, Tuesday and Thursday at 10 p.m. Dialogue is a production of the Coast 89.7 News. For story suggestions, contact 902-284-NEWS. That's 902-284-6397. Or email news@coastalradio.ca. For past episodes of Dialogue, check out our Dialogue podcasts, available now online at coastalradio.ca.